Well, good morning and welcome to the Mount. If you are joining us for the first time today, regardless of what campus you are at, we are so excited to spend this morning with you. If we haven't met, my name is Adam, and I have the privilege of being the lead pastor here at the Mount. Before we dive in this morning, I want to kind of give a special welcome to maybe you are joining us for the first time today or the first time in the last couple weeks maybe, and you have kind of moved to the area, you are new to the area. I just want to give a big Mount welcome. Maybe you are here because of some new career that has brought you to this part of the country. Maybe you're, you know, remote worker now and you're moving south, or maybe you're here at your new duty station, or maybe you circled around the second or third time back at this duty station. But we just wanted you to know that as a church, we're so excited you are here, and we are praying for you as you begin to settle in this new area. Maybe you have kids, and we're praying that your kids would find community and friendships quickly this summer, and that if you are here, that you would find a church home and community that you can belong to and thrive in. And so just as a church, we're glad you're here, and we are praying for you. And so today, you joined us for week number 5 in a series titled Catching Foxes. And what we've been doing is over the last month or so, we've been looking at this small Old Testament book by the name of Song of Songs, or depending on the translation you might be looking at, your Bible might say Song of Solomon. But we've been watching, as we've gone through the 8 chapters of this book, watching this young couple in the beginning as they have moved through these stages or phases of their relationship. And what we've been doing is we've been following along with them and asking the question, what does the Bible, what advice or wisdom does the Bible have for us in our marriage and our dating relationships based on what we see? And one of the common themes we have seen over and over again, if you've been here, is every single week, this small book sort of confronts us with this question. For those of us that are married, the question is, do you desire your spouse? Do you desire your spouse? Not, do you like your spouse? Not, do you love your spouse? But the book is confronting us with this question, is do you desire your spouse? Do you long for, want that intimacy, that physical and emotional intimacy, that friendship, that relationship that is different than just a friend or a roommate? Do you desire your spouse? And as we've been watching this couple, we've gotten the privilege of seeing their desire grow. If you were here in week 1, you'll remember that we saw this couple as they began to desire each other through their attraction, that initial stage of their relationship where they thought that each other were cute and they were interested in trying to swap numbers and all these things. And we saw them as they began this initial desire. And for those of us that are in a dating relationship, the question it asked us to wrestle with was, what are the qualities we should be looking for in someone we are dating? And for those of us that are single or maybe in a relationship, it also begs the question, what are the qualities that we should be living out in our own lives to be the type of person that the person we are seeking is also seeking? And for those of us that are married, those first couple weeks kind of challenged us with the idea that even if we're married, whether that's newlyweds or married for 50 or 60 years, what are the qualities and characteristics we should be developing in ourselves even as we mature in our relationship? And week number 2, we saw this desire begin to deepen with this couple as they moved into the courtship or engagement phase of their relationship, and they pursued each other with intentionality, making sure that Jesus and the gospel was the center of everything. And then week 3, we saw that desire sort of take full bloom in their wedding night, their honeymoon night, as they experienced that God-given gift of sex in their relationship. And then last week, if you were here, we picked up on the couple as they were sometime after that honeymoon, and the husband, the man was out working late doing something with his friends, and he comes home in the middle of the night and he, you know, reaches for the doorknob and he's trying to get to the bedroom to be with his wife, to be with her, and the door's locked and he cries out and says, let me come in. And scripture tells us in chapter 6 that she says, I've already taken off my sandals and I've taken off my robes, which is like ancient Hebrew for I have a headache, don't come in, right? And then there's this conflict. Why? Because he had an expectation and it wasn't met. And we said that for all of us, whether we're dating, whether it's just in our friendships or especially in our marriage, so much of our conflict and our disagreements is around unmet expectations. We expect our partner to be X, Y, or Z, and when they're not, we are mad. Now, sometimes those expectations are spoken. Other times, they're just internal expectations we've never communicated, but regardless, conflict ensues. And today, we'll pick up on the final week of our couple as they are in this new, more seasoned phase of their relationship. And just as a recap, we've said throughout this series that our core verse is from chapter 2, verse 15. And I hope you're beginning to memorize this verse by now if you've been here all the weeks, where the author tells us, he says, to catch all the, what does he say? To catch all the foxes. Catch all the foxes. He says, catch those pesky little foxes because they will ruin the vineyard of love, for the grapevines are blossoming. And if you're new, we've said that in ancient Israelite culture, foxes were these little sneaky creatures that would sneak into the vineyards and they would eat the grapes and eat the buds on the vines just as they were beginning to bloom, and it would destroy the crop. And the author here is telling you and I, when it comes to our love life, when it comes to our relationship with our significant other, whether that's dating or marriage, we have to be careful of the little pesky things that can ruin it. And those little things aren't major. They start as small things that, just left unchecked over time, then they create this drift and this chasm in our marriage. And today what I want to do as we close out this series is talk about what I think might be one of the biggest foxes of them all. And if you're taking notes, you might write this down: the fox of complacency. The fox of complacency. I really believe with everything in me that this week, this kind of final week of the series, has more potential than maybe all the others to kind of radically alter and change the course of some of our marriages. Why? Because I believe with everything in me that the greatest threat facing marriages today, and right, there are a lot of threats, and we could go through this list and talk about all the threats that are facing marriage. We could talk about sexual threats. We could talk about pornography. We could talk about infidelity. We could talk about social media. We could talk about all these threats. We could talk about our jobs and our careers and our schedules and all these things. But I think the greatest threat that is facing marriages today is this threat of complacency. Why? Because when our marriage has complacency, we're less likely to know anything's wrong. And here's what I mean by that. Because when we get complacent, we begin to kind of believe the cultural lie that when it comes to our marriage, the longer we are married, the more things become routine, the more we get settled, and that's just the way things are. And maybe you've said this about your spouse before. Well, that's just the way things are. And what happens is we would say, Adam, there's nothing bad about my marriage. There's nothing majorly wrong. It's not in a catastrophe mode. It's not on fire. There's nothing bad about my marriage, and so I'm just complacent. And that in there is where the greatest danger and the greatest threat is, because there's nothing bad about it, but it's also not great. In fact, many of us, I would argue, would say my marriage is just okay. And let me just be honest with you this morning. When I read Scripture, all 66 books from Genesis to Revelation, I don't get any hint that God's desire for your marriage is for it to just be okay. In fact, I think God's desire for your marriage is that our marriage is a picture of Him and His relationship with the church, and it is thriving, and it is exciting, and it is full of passion and desire and fulfillment and meaning in life. He wants us to have a great marriage, not a marriage that is just okay. And the problem is, when we become complacent, we stop being intentional. We begin to settle. We begin to react instead of being proactive. In fact, that's where I would say most marriages go to die, that gap between good intentions and actions. You guys have probably experienced this before. I talk to couples all the time, and sometimes when they begin to kind of confess the things that are frustrating them, the things that are making their marriage not what it could be, there's a lot of like, well, I meant to do this. I meant to do this. I know I didn't do that, but I meant to do this. Most marriages have really good intentions, but there is a difference between good intentions and actions. And most often, that gap in the middle is where marriages settle. It's where they go to be complacent. And here's what I want us to see: that God has so much more for you. In fact, I would argue that outside of centering your marriage relationship on the person and work of Jesus, the greatest thing you can do is fight against complacency and lean in with some intentionality. And so what I want to do this morning is I want to look at the last two chapters of this book and follow this couple and see what we can learn about their intentional way they are with each other. And as we do this, I'm just going to preface this and just say, today's going to feel really, really, really simple. But here's the reality. Sometimes the most profound things in life are the simple things done consistently. And so we'll start in chapter 7, verse 1, when the man says this to the woman. He says, "How beautiful your sandaled feet, O prince's daughter. Your graceful legs," and some of the translations say your rounded thighs. It says your graceful legs are like jewels, the work of an artist's hands. What I love about this, and we're going to pause here for just a second, is this guy is kind of doing what he's done for the last seven chapters. He's complimenting his bride, his wife. He's complimenting her. But all of the other times he's complimented her, in chapter 1, chapter 2, and chapter 3, and chapter 4, he always started with the top down. He would talk about her hair, and then her eyes, and then her nose, and then her neck, and then her chest, and then work his way down. And here, after all of these years of being married, men, let me just give you some advice. Sometimes saying the same compliment over and over again, it's not going to work. You got to mix it up a little bit. And so now, instead of starting from the top down, he's wise and he's going to start from the bottom up. Creative genius here, right? And so he says, "How beautiful are your feet? Oh, they're like prince's daughter." And he says, your graceful legs," I love the other translation, your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of an artist's hand. He says, "You are molded and crafted and shaped by God." He continues, verse 2. He says, "Your navel is a rounded goblet that never lacks blended what?" Blended, let's try this again. He says, your navel is a rounded goblet that never lacks blended wine. And your waist is a mound of wheat encircled by lilies. So, if you're joining us for the first time today, his compliments are really good when you understand the context. Men, just remember, don't just say these things to your wife. Don't go up to your wife today and be like, "Honey, like your belly is like a sack of oats. It looks good, right?" Like that's not the idea here. Unless, like, what's the man saying here, right? So he says that your navel is like a goblet that never lacks blended wine. Wine to an ancient Israelite was a delicacy. It was what would happen when there was fun and excitement, and it was at parties, and it was good for enjoyment, and it was special occasions. And he says, "Your waist is a mound of wheat." Wheat was like a staple crop. Without wheat, the Israelites would die. They wouldn't have the food they needed. And so it literally, in essence, wheat was this life-giving thing. And so here is this man, after all of these years of marriage, he's looking at his wife, talking from the feet up, and he begins to say things like, "You still bring me excitement. I still find you fun. I still have joy in your presence. And you're life-giving to me. When I'm with you, I feel better. You bring out the best in me." He's building her up. He's saying things about her. Verse 3, he continues. He says, "Your breasts are like two fawns, like twin fawns of a gazelle." So now he gets creative and tries some new things, but then he still comes back to his greatest hits, right? Like, he said this multiple times. So, like, husbands, wives, sometimes if you find a compliment that when you say it, 9 out of 10 times it leads to something, maybe you need to keep that compliment in the bag, right? And so he, for some reason, he has kept this one in his bag. But even after all these years, he says, "Man, I still find enjoyment in you and excitement." It continues. He says, "Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes are the pools of Heshbon by the gate of Bath-Rabban." That's deep. He says, "Your nose is like the tower of Lebanon looking toward Damascus." Here's what I want you to see here. He's telling her things about her, not just her physical character, but her personality. He says, "Your neck is like an ivory tower. You are elegant. You are impressive. Your eyes are like the pools of Heshbon. Your eyes are deep. Your soul has character. And they're pure, and I can see through it." And the pool had healing power. He says, "You restore me. You bring health to me." He says, "Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon. You are royal, and you are strong, and you look toward the enemy, and you bring protection for me and my family. This man is not just complimenting her physicalness. He's not just talking about the things he only talked about when they were younger. He does talk about those, but he's talking about so much more, her character, her beauty, her personality. And he continues in verse 5, and he says this. He says, your head crowns you like Mount Carmel. So he's worked all the way up. He says, your hair is like royal tapestry. The king is held captive by its tresses. Now, I don't know why, but remember when on their wedding night, if you were here, she let her hair down and he said, your hair is like the goats kind of running back and forth on the mountains. For some reason, this guy really likes her hair. And so now he says, your hair, it held the king captive by its tresses. In other words, the word captive in ancient Israel, the Hebrew, the original language, it was this word for literally meaning like bound prisoner or taken captive or a hostage or a slave. And so what he's telling her is he says, after all these years, when you let your hair down and do that thing you do, you know, he's like, I go weak in the knees and I'm in love with you. I'm held captive by who you are. Now, here's what I want you to see. Even after all of these years, and we don't know how long it's been. Most commentators would say it's been quite a while. But even after all these years, what is he doing to her? He's complimenting her. But notice what he's not doing. He's not on his way to get a bagel and coffee, heading to the Keurig, being like, hey, babe, you look hot today. Or you look beautiful today. He's being very, very specific. Very, very detailed. In fact, you get the sense that he has thought ahead of time what he wants to say to her. He's being incredibly, incredibly intentional. How do we fight the fox of complacency in our marriage? First, we need to be intentional with our words. We need to be intentional with our words. This man was incredibly intentional and very specific with the words he told his wife. He thought of them in advance. He thought these good things about his spouse. And he didn't just think them and keep them in his mind. He said them. And the beauty is this. This is so simple and so easy that we hear this and think, well, yeah, that makes sense. But it is also incredibly profound because of the way we are as human beings naturally. What do I mean by that? For instance, let's escape our significant relationships for a second. Let's just think as a country as a whole for this moment. We as human beings, naturally, when we hear something about someone, when we experience something, or when we see or hear about a situation, and we don't have all the details, we inherently, naturally default to assuming the worst and thinking something negative. And you may say, no, I don't. Yes, you do. Okay? I'm just letting you know. This is the reason why we can assume the worst in people so often. This is the reason why we sometimes love news cycles because they give us the point of view of like, what's being hidden? What's not being said? What are we missing out on? What's the real trick? We always assume the negative in silence. Are you tracking? Now, take that in the context of your marriage. When you do something for your spouse, and maybe you've had this before, I know my wife has, where she has done something and she's put thought and intentionality and effort into it and she's planned it and all these things and I'm just like, awesome. In her mind, she's probably going back to her room or going into our room or thinking to herself, did I do something wrong? Does he not love me? Did he not appreciate it? Was it not good enough? Was this? Because we assume in silence negative. And here's what that means. That means the longer that you are married, the trend or trajectory will be to say, this is just the way things are. I'm going to speak about these less because that person already knows them. So therefore, I don't have to constantly say them. But in the midst of your silence, instead of being like, well, I know that person feels this way. I know they think this way. Instead, they begin to fill that gap with suspicion and negative thoughts. Which means in your marriage, every good thought that you think but refuse to say is depriving your spouse of a God-given blessing for their thought life. You literally have the ability to change the way they think about themselves. Your words matter. Every time you think something good about your spouse, say it. And I mean say it. Say it. If you can't say it, text them, FaceTime them, call them, send them a note, mail them a letter, send them a Facebook message. Communicate every single thing that you think that is good about your spouse, everything you notice that is admirable and worthy and true. Say it. Don't leave them with the gift of not knowing how you actually feel about them. I'll give you an example of this from my life. A couple years ago, I was reading through Philippians. And I got to Philippians chapter 4, verse 8, and there's this verse that, and I'll paraphrase for you, it's where Paul's writing to the church in Philippi, and he says that they are to, he's instructing them to think about, and he lists these things that people should think about. He says, whatever's pure, whatever's noble, whatever's holy, whatever's righteous, good, excellent, praiseworthy, and he says, those are the sort of things you want to dwell on and think on. And as I was reading that verse, I began to realize that even after 20 years of marriage now, right, my wife and I will celebrate 20 years this December. And I will say, like, our marriage is not perfect, right? Like, no marriage is perfect because marriage is two sinful people who live in a house together, and that's not a perfect situation. And so our marriage is not perfect. But I will say, after 20 years of living together, 20 years of being married, every single year our marriage seems to be growing deeper and deeper and more intimate. And we are at this place right now that feels really, really good. But I noticed a couple years ago, as I was reading Philippians, that I wasn't communicating my words to my wife very well. And so I began this journey where for 365 days, for a full year, I took a journal, and every single day, I would write down something in that journal that I noticed about her that day that was good, right, pure, holy, admirable, excellent, whatever it happened to be. And at the end of the year, I gave her that journal for her to kind of look through, to know how I felt about her. But what was amazing is as the year progressed, by the time I actually gave her the journal, if she looks through it, she would probably be like, he's already said this about me, he's already said this about me. Because the very act of thinking those things in my head caused me to want to say them, to be intentional with the words that I wanted to say to her. And what began to change was not just how she viewed me, but how I viewed her. I began to celebrate more and not focus on so many of the negative things that maybe before were always on my mind. Because here's the reality. There's a difference between thinking something and saying something. You can admire the heck out of your spouse, but if you don't say it, they don't know it. You have to celebrate what you see. And here's the beautiful thing about this, the way God has created us, is as human beings, we love to repeat what gets celebrated. In fact, if you're taking notes, you might write that down. What is celebrated is what gets repeated. And so the things that you want to see in your spouse, the things that are good, the things that bring you joy, the things that you look at them and say, this is the person I fell in love with and I'm so excited to be with them for the rest of my life. The more you celebrate those things with your words, the more they in turn will do those things and the less you begin to focus on their flaws. And that's what I love about this man here. Instead of looking at head down like he's always done, he flips his perspective and looks feet first. And maybe every time you look at your spouse right now, all you can see is their flaws and the things you don't like and the disappointments and the frustrations, maybe instead of continuously focusing on those, you need to flip your perspective and look from a different angle. And you need to see that they truly are a good gift from God for you, and there are things about them that you can celebrate and point out. Because here's the reality, is you and I as human beings, when it comes to our marriage relationship, good intentions are not enough. We have to actually say it. Because I talk with couples all the time in my office, and they'll talk about like where they're at in their marriage and what's going on. And what's interesting is so many times what you hear is people say, man, I really wanted to do that. I wanted to do that, but I just didn't. And here's what I know. You judge yourself based on your intentions, but you judge your spouse based on their actions. You say, they didn't do this. Oh, but that's, I mean, I wanted to, I meant to do that. You judge yourself based on your intentions and they judge you based on your actions. You need to say what you need to say. And you may say, man, I just don't see a lot of good things in them right now. Like, let me talk to the ladies for a minute. Maybe you're like, man, I really would give more than anything for my husband to be the spiritual leader in our home, but he's not. Let me just give you some advice. Remember, what is celebrated is what gets repeated. Maybe the next time you're sitting down for a meal or it's Thanksgiving or whatever happens and it's your husband's, you know, he's going to pray for the dinner and he prays for the meal. Immediately after the meal, maybe you go over to him and you sneak into the kitchen and you whisper to him and you're like, hey, by the way, when you said that prayer, I just want you to know I love you so much and you were like a spiritual giant and the way you prayed that prayer turned me on so much and I think you are so sexy right now. Listen, he will pray a lot if you say that to him, right? Because what is celebrated is what gets repeated. The longer you are married, the more you assume they know. Are you being intentional with your words? How's your marriage? Are you being intentional with your words? He continues, verse 6. He says, how beautiful you are and how pleasing my love with your delights. Your stature is like that of the palm, and your breasts like clusters of fruit. I said, I will climb the palm. I love that he said, I said, like I'm claiming this, right? Like, I will climb the palm tree. I will take hold of its fruit. He continues. And he says, may your breast be like clusters of grapes on the vine and the fragrance of your breath, the apples, and your mouth like the best wine. Now, I don't really have a reason for reading this. I just feel like the passage about him climbing the palm tree should be read quite often. And so I think it helps with memorization the more we read it. But no, in reality, what I want you to see is after all these years of marriage, he still wants her. In other words, he still desires her. He talked about her feet, her legs, her stomach, her breast, her neck, her nose, her hair, her personality. He desires and wants all of her, even after all of these years. And look at how she responds in verse 10. She says, I belong to my beloved, and his what? His desire is for me. That word desire in the original Hebrew language is this idea of pursuit and want with this passionate lust. And maybe the best way to kind of a mental picture, if you're thinking of that, think of some sort of like National Geographic, Animal Planet, like nature show where the lion or the cheetah is hiding in the grass and the gazelle is over here. And all of a sudden the lion or the cheetah runs after it and it's pursuing it and chasing it with the idea that it wants to grab it and not let go of it. And she is saying, basically, she's saying, my husband, my beloved, he wants me. He pursues me. He desires me. After all of these years, don't miss this, his desire is not for another woman. His desire is not for what he looks at on his phone or his computer screen. His desire is not for his career. His desire is not for having the best blank. He desires me. And she feels that. I'm just curious this morning. In your marriage, husbands, wives, does your spouse feel that you desire them above everything else? Do they know that? I talk to so many couples, and the way they talk about their spouse, you would think that they are annoyed to death with that person. Here's a couple who, even after all these years, desires each other more than anything else. And because of that, look at her response. Look at what she initiates, verse 11. She says, come, my beloved. Let us go where? Let us go to the countryside. Let us go to the countryside. Let us spend the night in the villages. In other words, she said, man, you have spent this time complimenting me, my character, my personality, and you desire me. And it isn't just because you want something in this moment. You desire me, the holistic me, over all of these years. And because of that, I want you to know as your wife, listen, let us go to the countryside. In other words, she's like, hey, listen, honey, guess what? I got us a nice little bed and breakfast. I got us a nice little hotel near the mountains. We're going to go, and we're going to go spend some time together, just you and I. We're going to get away from the kids, get away from life, and we're going to go and just spend some time together and be involved in each other's lives, and it's going to be intentional. Why? Because one of the ways that we fight the fox of complacency in our marriage is not just being intentional with our words, but is being intentional with our time. It is being intentional with our time. And listen, as a pastor, it breaks my heart when I talk to couples all the time in serious and casual conversations, and it's consistently week after week, over and over and over again, I hear people, and it's almost like this become this norm where they're like, yeah, you know, we're just really busy right now. Like, you know, we haven't had a date night in forever. I can't remember the last time we got away from the kids. We just never have done that. Oh, we haven't gone away, just the two of us, in forever. We just are so busy right now with soccer, with this and this and this and this, and life's just chaotic right now. But it seems like everyone else we talk to is in the same boat, and it's just how culture is. Everyone's so busy, no one has time to get away and do things together. And I hear this, and I just want to look at them and kind of grab them and shake them and say, listen, if your goal is to be like everyone else, that's fine, but hopefully if you're building your life on a biblical marriage, your goal is not to be like everyone else. Your goal is to be different. Your goal is to have a marriage that's not just okay, but a marriage that is great. And sometimes that means, listen, healthy, thriving, successful marriages do the things that everyone else is not doing so that they can last the distance. And that might mean for some of you, you need to be intentional with your time. Stop giving your spouse the leftovers. Stop giving your spouse just what's at the end of the day when you're exhausted and tired. Be intentional with your time. And that'll look different for every single one of us in the room. For some of you, that may mean at nighttime when the kids are asleep and you, instead of going down to the basement or going to your living room and turning on the TV, you turn the TV off. You close the laptop. You put your phone in the other room, and instead of sitting side by side looking this way, you face each other and you look each other in the face and you communicate and you talk and you chat and you reconnect. Maybe you find a board game to play. Maybe you go do something fun together around the house, but you intentionally use your time to invest in each other. For some of you, that may look like setting aside consistent time to have a date night. Maybe that's monthly, maybe that's weekly, but setting aside intentional time where you are saying, this is on the calendar, we're doing this, we're scheduling in advance, we're being intentional with it, and no one's gonna touch it, and we are gonna spend time together as a couple, making sure that we are a priority because I value you and I cherish you. And I know that, like, we're all in different phases of life, and you're like, man, Adam, we really took heart to week three, and we've got 10 kids. You know, we got like a 15-passenger van. We can't possibly pay for a babysitter to watch all these people. I understand that. Get creative. Put all the kids to bed and set up a date night in the basement. I remember my wife and I, when we were younger and we didn't make near as much as a pastor and our kids were younger and it was really hard to kind of find a babysitter, one of the things that we consistently did for a season is we would put our kids to bed and we would go out on the porch together and we would sit down like an old married couple and we would talk and watch shows and laugh and do random silly things, and it was intentional time together. And other times in our marriage, we've had days, I'm off on Fridays, where we've spent Fridays as our date day and we'll go out while the kids are in school. We've gotten creative. Maybe you need to get creative and be intentional with your time. You will never drift into it. And maybe for some of you, I would encourage for all of you, maybe once a year, what you need to do is set aside some intentional time to go away, even if it's just for a night. There is something that happens when you and your spouse go away, when you, even if it's just down the road to a new place, when you go away, even for a night, you connect on a different level and you intentionally make each other a priority. And listen, here's what this means. You're gonna have to say no to a lot of things and a lot of people. And that's okay. And I know some of you have a really hard time with the word no. In fact, like you try to pronounce it and it doesn't even come out. And let me just give you the freedom to tell people no. Because you can say yes to all these things in your life, but every yes is a no to your spouse. And when you're 80, 90, 100 years old, they're gonna be what's left, and I hope you said yes to them a lot more than you said no to them. Make them a priority with intentionality with your time. She continues, verse 12. She says, let's go to the countryside. And she says, let us go early to the vineyards. Like, she wants to get up early on their time away. That's not an ideal thing, but she wants to go early to the vineyards. It's like a farmer's market maybe, right? Like, let's go early to the vineyards to see if the vines have budded, if their blossoms have opened, and if the pomegranates are in bloom. And she says, there I will give you my love. Take that for what you want. right? She says, there, when we get there to that bed and breakfast, that hotel room, that's where I'll give you my love. She continues, she says this. Now, if there are children in the room, this is going to get a little spicy. I apologize. Here we go. So she says the what? She says the mandrakes send out their fragrance, and at our door is every delicacy, both what? Both new and old, that I have stored up for you, my beloved. So let's unpack this here. What are mandrakes? Beginning in the book of Genesis, every time a mandrake is referenced, because of ancient Israelite culture, mandrake was it was an aphrodisiac. Men or women would take it, and the thought was, because the way the roots looked, they looked like either a male part or they looked like female spread thing. And so the men or the women would eat these things, and the goal here was it would increase sexual desire and vitality. One of the commentaries I read, he said the mandrake was basically the Viagra of ancient times, if that helps you understand what it is. So these mandrakes are sort of like this enhancement thing, right? It's hey, I want to eat this. And so she says, listen, we're going to go away to the countryside, and we're going to get a bed and breakfast, and we're going to get a room, and I'm bringing some mandrakes. We're going to have some fun. And she said, not only am I bringing mandrakes, but we're going to do some stuff new and some stuff old. She says, I know we've been married for a long time, but I still got some new tricks up my sleeve. We're going to get away. Maybe she bought something new. I don't know. Maybe she's bringing something new. Maybe she's doing something new. I have no idea. But she says, we're going to have these mandrakes, and we're going to have fun, and we're going to try something new and old. Why? And this is important. Why? Because I have stored this up for you. In Hebrew, that word stored is this idea of thinking ahead and planning ahead and being intentional, right? You don't survive winter on accident. You store ahead. You save. In other words, this woman is looking at her husband, and I'll unpack the application in a minute. She is looking at her husband, and she's saying, listen, honey, we've been married a really long time, but we're going to get away. We're going to be intentional with our time, and we're going to get away. We're going to go to a bed and breakfast. We're going to go to a hotel room. We're going to get away, and we're going to have some fun and do some new things, because I've thought about what we're going to do ahead of time, and I'm planning something that will be a blessing to you. In other words, we need to be intentional with our actions. What do I mean by that? The longer you are married, the more you drift from doing the intentional things that bring your spouse joy. When you were newlyweds, right, you would show up no matter how bad your day was at work. If you showed up and there was dishes to be done, you'd be like, no, honey, you say, I got the dishes, and you'd go do the dishes, and you guys were fighting over who made the bed because you wanted to outserve the other person. You wanted to give a back rub with no expectations, right? You were being the total person willing to serve and serve and serve, and you were going out of your way doing things that would intentionally bless your significant other. But the longer you are married, the less you do those things. And here's what we see. After all of these years, both husband and both wife, they say, hey, listen, I love you so much, and I enjoy you so much, that I want to do things for you that bring you joy. And that looks different for every single person, but you know your spouse. Are you being intentional with your acts? And then we'll fast forward. The book closes in chapter 8, verse 14, with this. It says, make haste, come quickly, be quick, my beloved, and like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. We've talked about this before. I won't talk about it anymore. But here's what I want you to see. After all of these years in their marriage, she in essence is saying, husband, hurry home, come quick, because I want to have fun. Do you desire your spouse? That's the Song of Songs. Do you desire your spouse? And you may say, why does it matter, Adam? Because marriage is a picture of the gospel. What do I mean? Marriage is a picture of the story of Jesus Christ. Marriage is a picture of how much Jesus loves the church, how much Jesus desires the church, how much Jesus never gives up on the church. How much Jesus cares for you. How much Jesus pursues you. How much Jesus loves you. How much Jesus lays down himself for you. That's the beauty of marriage. When you desire your spouse, when you lay down your wants, when you seek their fulfillment, their enjoyment, and their blessing, you are modeling to the world what it means when Jesus loves them. Do you desire your spouse? Marriage is holy, so much more than you think. Let's pray. Jesus, we are so thankful for you. God, as we wrap up this series, we just want to pause and say, Jesus, we are thankful for you, for your grace, for your goodness, for your mercy, your love, your compassion, your willingness to lay down your life on a cross for us. God, it is only through you that we are even able to exist in a room with another sinful human being over the course of a lifetime. You are good. God, I pray for our church. Across all of our campus. I pray for Fredericksburg. I pray for Stafford. I pray for Bealton. I pray for everyone watching online. I pray that we would be a church, not just of okay marriages, but of great, God-honoring, passionately in love and full of desire type of marriages. Marriages that when people in our community see us, they say, what's so different about them? What do they have that I don't have? And they begin to ask questions. And our marriage opens up the door for us to be able to share the good news that is your son with them. Because marriage is a picture of your love for us. As we continue praying, maybe you are here this morning. And here's what I love about this book, Song of Songs. It is 8 chapters about marriage and dating, but it's also 8 chapters about God's love for you. You see, God is kind of like the lover, the man. And God is pursuing you. Relentlessly, over and over and over again. And let's just be honest with each other for a minute. Maybe you have been walking through life far from God, and you have felt him pursuing you, and you've ignored it. Maybe other people have tried to tell you about it, and you've shunned the conversation. Maybe you've even come to church before, and in the stillness of these prayer moments, you felt something in your soul, but you've never wanted to respond. And I wanted to tell you that God will never stop pursuing you on this side of heaven, because just like the bride in this story, he loves you forever and ever and ever. And so the best thing you can do is finally surrender and trust and have belief and faith in his goodness and his love. Across all of our campuses, if you are here this morning, I want to give you a chance to do that. If you want to surrender your life to Jesus, to trust in him for salvation for the very first time, with all of our eyes closed and heads bowed, would you be bold and just lift your hand right where you are? Jesus, I need you. If you prayed this, or if you raised your hand, will you pray this prayer with me? Father, I am a sinner. Jesus, come into my life. Make me new. Be my King. Be my Lord. Today, I trust in your work on the cross for my salvation. Jesus, and everyone said,